This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Americans get married every day of the year, but right now we are headed into the heart of the wedding season, the wedding business, and what a business it is. White tents, tall cakes, months in the making, and budgets headed over the moon. Bride and groom dreaming of one perfect day, as New Yorker writer Rebecca Mead calls it, and everybody getting taken for a giddy ride. Mead has gone coast to coast and into the giant wedding dress factories of China. Now she's staring the deluxe, new, megabucks American wedding in the face and asking, what are we doing here? Up next on Point, the great American wedding and what it's become. Joining me now from New York is Rebecca Mead, staff writer at The New Yorker magazine. She's gone on a big wedding safari and come back to tell the story in her new book, One Perfect Day, The Selling of the American Wedding. Rebecca Mead, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here.
So what's new? We've had weddings for a long time with bridal marches and big gowns and lots of cake. What's new?
Well, what's new is the scale. I mean, it's always been the case that there have been weddings and there have been big weddings. And it's also always been the case that there have been people selling you stuff for your wedding. But what's new is the scale. There's now this enormous industry, an ever-proliferating industry, with more and more people realizing that this is a great consumer to attract to your business or your service. You know, it's well known in the wedding industry that this is one occasion in a woman's life when, and a man's life too, when she can be expected and more or less guaranteed to pay full price for something. So there's more and more people from everything from, you know, bridal boot camp exercise classes to get your biceps into shape to a dance studio teaching you and your groom how to execute the perfect first dance to, you know, it just, the list just goes on and on. There's more and more people trying to get in on the party.
Never mind the food, the hall, and all the rest. $28,000 for the average, that's a pretty good chunk of change. And of course, we know that means a lot more for many weddings, but also less for some weddings. You write about, though, in the middle of this, what many have called it, and you call the bridezilla culture. I guess I'm just out of it. That was new to me. What's a bridezilla?
You'd never heard of a bridezilla?
Sorry.
Wow, I'm amazed. Well, bridezilla is this this figure, this kind of caricature that emerged in around 2000. And, you know, the word derives from Godzilla. She is a bride who turns into a monster. And the suggestion is that this new breed of bride who gets so obsessed with her wedding planning that all she can focus on upon is, you know, whether her bridesmaids have all lost enough weight to fit into their bridal gowns and look beautiful, or whether they've all got their hair dyed the same shade of blonde, or, you know, whether her napkins are the right color to match the insides of the envelopes of the letters that she sent out as save the date cards. And I mean, this kind of obsessive concern with detail and sort of monstrous behavior, behaving as if there was nothing in the world more important than her wedding. And this is the caricature of the bridezilla, and it became kind of a popular caricature. There's TV shows about bridezillas and books about bridezillas and many newspaper and magazine articles that would tell stories of the kind of egregious excesses. And, you know, this made me think and stop and think, because I think whenever a stereotype like that really grips the public imagination, you have to ask yourself, there's something more going on here. What else is going on here? What is this pointing to? And what I think this is pointing to is not so much that there are individual brides who go crazy about their weddings, which of course is true, and those stories may be amusing if cruel to hear, but I think what the story of the bridezilla, the character of the bridezilla, really indicates is that there's a much larger sense of disquiet among people at large about the state of weddings at large, that there is a general feeling, I think, and I get this from talking to many, many people while I was doing this, reporting for the book, that a lot of people are feeling, hey, something's gone wrong here. Something is out of control. And all of weddings, the whole wedding business is out of control. And the way that we do weddings is out of control. And so we have this poor figure of the bridezilla, who is like a safe corner into which we can quarantine those feelings of disquiet, and we can say, oh, it's, you know, just the bridezilla acting out. But no, you know, I think it's much more widespread, and there's a much larger, more widespread disquiet than that.
We'll hear some of your analysis of both the lavishness and disquiet that you're reading there, but give us a sense of how you went about sort of tracking down this great beast, Rebecca. How did you go out into the world, and what did you find when you went there? Bridezillas or excesses, or even unto China, where so many bridal gowns get made. Give us a sense of your travels, your safari.
Right. Well, what I did was, I decided, everybody goes to weddings. Everybody knows what weddings look like from the front, as it were. And what I wanted to do was look behind the scenes and look at weddings from the point of view of the people that put them together, the industries that thrive and flourish upon them. So what I did was I went and talked to people who are wedding professionals. I went to conferences for wedding planners and for videographers. I went to classes where you can learn how to become a wedding planner. I went to Las Vegas to seminars for bridal gown retailers. I went to China, indeed, to a wedding dress factory to see how wedding dresses are made. I went to the Caribbean to look at the honeymoon industry. I went specifically there to the island of Aruba, where the marriage laws were changed a few years ago, because it was realized that the American wedding market was such a powerful and lucrative one that, you know, they wanted to make it easier for Americans to get married there.
Right.
And so they changed the marriage laws. And now 1 in 3 couples who get married in Aruba are American tourists. So I wanted to look at the way in which the wedding business, has this impact sort of even beyond our shores, but also to see, what is going into all of this. We only see, or most people only see, the finished product. And I wanted to talk to the people that are making the products and building the expectations and building the dream, too.
The dream at the heart of it. You say the selling of this kind of wedding, though of course there are genuine dreams there as well. But lift the veil on what you found when you went into those places. Maybe start with, the heart of the industry when at the conferences. I'm not even sure what the wedding industry means. It's a video guy here and a caterer there. I'm not sure how it all fits together. But what are the messages that you heard when you got behind that veil?
Well, the suggestion is, and the promise is, that from the minute you become engaged, you must, this is especially the bride, although the groom is a lesser party, but still a significant one. And from the perspective of the wedding industry, a growing one who's growing in importance, because increasingly grooms are paying for their own weddings, and so it's not just the bride's party anymore. But most of the marketing is focused and targeted to the brides. And the suggestion, if you're a bride, is that from the minute you become engaged, and the average engagement now in the United States is 16 to 17 months.
Longer than it used to be, you point out.
Yeah, it's much longer. But the suggestion is that for this period, you are engaged upon a program of self-improvement. This is your opportunity to sort of fulfill every New Year's resolution that you've ever made, but this time to succeed at it. So you go on a diet, you start an exercise program, you whiten your, you go through a sort of teeth whitening process, so you'll look wonderful in your photographs. I was at a seminar for brides that was hosted by Brides Magazine, a very upscale bridal fair in New York City, and one of the questions that was put to the editors of Brides Magazine was, when should I start getting facials? And the answer was, as soon as you get engaged. So for this, year and a half, whatever, you're involved in this intense program of self-improvement. And the suggestion is that if you do all of this, and if you do it properly, which is to say by the book, you will create the perfect day. And that will translate into a life of happiness thereafter. I mean, the suggestion is a subtle one. It's not that, as if they're promising you that
But that as if it's a kind of magic ritual. Put all these pieces in a row and you will then have the perfect marriage, happily ever after.
Exactly, exactly. And I think there's a lot of magical thinking operating. I mean, people, you know, believe and hope. And, you know, of course people are hopeful at the beginning of a marriage. I mean, everybody enters a marriage with great hope. And so what the business does is it taps into this very profound yearning and wish and desire on the part of everybody who's getting married that this is going to be the right thing to do, that this is going to be a happy event and the herald of a happy life thereafter. So it, you know, it plays upon one's very, very profoundest emotions.
And yet it is the celebration of a really big day. I mean, events don't get much bigger than marriage. Are you a sourpuss at the party here, Rebecca?
No, I'm really not. I mean, I like going to weddings, and I often cry at them. I mean, I'm very, you know, I'm as moved by them, and I'm as moved by the commitment and the you know, and I'm also married. You know, I'm as moved by the desire to make this statement as the next person. But what I'm looking at and what I'm interested in is, you know, why does that desire to make a statement, make a commitment, why does that translate into you know, buying a lot of stuff? Why do we express ourselves through the products that we buy, and how do the people who are selling us those products persuade us that that is the best way we should go about expressing ourselves?
We're talking this hour about the American wedding and what it's become, the wedding industrial complex, and our new wedding day dreams. In 1991 movie The Father of the Bride, Steve Martin plays George Banks, who goes slightly crazy as he gears up and funds his daughter's big day. Here's a little bit where he and his wife Nina, played by Diane Keaton, try to winnow their wedding guest invite list, which begins at more than 500 people.
Now invite as many people as you want to the church. Pack them in. Build a grandstand if you want, but we are not having more than 150 people in this house on the day of the wedding. All right, let's start eliminating.
Okay. Jim Pepper and wife.
Oh, great. Start with one of my guys.
Fine. We'll start with one of mine. I'll cut Steve and Stephanie Terrell. They're very good clients
of mine. Say no more of their history.
All right, Jim Pepper and wife.
I've known the guy for 20 years.
You haven't seen him in 15, George.
All right, I'll say I lost his address.
Father of the Bride, and there it goes. Rebecca Mead has jumped in with a big new book, One Perfect Day, The Selling of the American Wedding. Jonathan's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hey, Jonathan, what's going on?
Hey, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
True story, I'm in the parking lot to the reception hall right now because I have, my fiance has asked me to bring the coordinator this ribbon because the napkins on the table do not match the gift boxes.
Big trouble.
we're getting married exactly a week and one day from today.
And I heard the word coordinator as in wedding planner. Have you hired one?
Absolutely. Everybody's been hired, paid.
Is it holding your costs down to have a wedding planner, Jonathan?
No, it's not really. Not really. We've gone over budget, in my opinion, by a lot, but in her opinion, it's not that much.
What was your budget, and where are you now?
Well, we began wanting to stay around somewhere around $17,000, and it's going to end up, after everybody said and done, about $38,000, which is a whole bunch.
Who's paying? Who's paying, Jonathan? You?
Her? Parents,
yeah?
Her parents, me, her, everybody's chipping in. But that's the painful bottom figure, and I feel the only reason I'm following her up with you know, matching the napkins to the ribbon and the gift box and all that.
Where you're standing right now in the reception hall with that ribbon in your hand, yeah. Why are you on board for all this?
Well, because we've paid so much, and I can understand why she wants everything perfect that day. Is because so she doesn't feel it like she got taken advantage of. We have to justify all this money by having a perfect wedding, and if it's not, then she just kind of feels like we just wasted a bunch of money.
Oh boy, you're in a vicious cycle, but we hope and pray that it comes up with a perfect day and a very happy one. Jonathan, thanks for that report from the front lines, and congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
There you go, Rebecca. In a nutshell, you've got your story.
Yeah, I mean, this is it exactly, right? And I mean, congratulations, Jonathan, and see you on the other side. You know, the professionalization of weddings is something that I was very interested in, and there are growing ranks of wedding coordinators and wedding professionals. And as I went to classes where you learn how to become one, and there are tricks of the trade, such as, you know, if you're a wedding planner and you're going to visit a potential client, you drive up in your car and you can guess by what their house looks like and what kind of car they're driving, how big their budget is going to be. So, you know, the idea that weddings have become a sphere into which, you know, there is a professional tier is a new one. I mean, you know, people, there were certain members of society who always would have, you know, hired help. But the idea that, you know, very ordinary people now have hired help and very ordinary people also become wedding planners, you know, this is new. The scale of this is new.
And, of course, who's paying may be a little changed as well. Jonathan said at this point everybody's paying, often both
right.
bride and groom's families chipping in. You write that means for the wedding planner, for the industry, many more pockets to get into.
Well, exactly. I mean, they're thrilled by this because it used to be that it was just the father of the bride. Now there are that many more people who can be called upon to contribute.
And they do. Let's go to Adrian in Buffalo, New York. Adrian, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I got married a few years ago in San Francisco.
Good.
And the biggest thing for me was to not break the bank for my dad. And we got away with having a fabulous wedding for $6,000. And I'm sure most people would think that that's absolutely unheard of, but we were resourceful. We pieced it together. We used a friend who was a caterer. We had 90 people in the heart of downtown San Francisco.
Wow.
And it was memorable. It was fabulous. I'm still married to my husband. I just don't feel that spending an exorbitant amount of money equates to long-term happiness.
Adrian, we hear it loud and clear, and we picture flowers in your hair in San Francisco. It's easy to see. Rebecca Mead, there was a time, maybe my time, when an awful lot of people didn't get married on this grand scale. It was sort of, you know, out in a meadow maybe, or somewhere, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. at a park or in the woods. And the scale of things was less. What happened to that old image? Is that a kind of 60s, 70s, gone with the wind view of marriage?
Well, there was very much in the 60s and 70s, there was this trend towards people having weddings that were influenced by the counterculture in that way, where you get married out in the woods and so on. And this was very alarming at the time to the wedding business. And there's a very funny survey that was produced by the wedding dress, by a trade association representing bridal gown industry from the 60s, saying in which they discovered, helpfully enough for their own purposes, that your marriage was more likely to endure if you married in a long formal gown than if you married in a miniskirt.
No barefoot brides, please.
Right. No, exactly. You know, but this in the 70s, the wedding, you know, people I've talked to who were in the wedding business in those days, you know, they were worried because, you know, the American marriage wasn't looking so great. Divorce rates were going up and everybody was wondering, oh, what does this mean for us? Then there was a great sigh of relief after the wedding of Charles and Diana, which, of course, was this spectacular princess. I mean,
all the trimmings you could ever imagine.
Exactly. And that was embraced by the people in the wedding business with this sigh of relief and statements about a return to tradition. And, you know, that had a great deal to do with boosting. You know, this is the beginning of the 1980s, so we now enter the era of, the Reagan era of luxury and excess. And so it was all fitting together to create bigger weddings once again. I think now one of the main influences on the way in which people decide to have their weddings is celebrity culture. And the suggestion now is that, you know, every bride is a celebrity on the day of her wedding. This is her day on the red carpet. This is her movie premiere. You know, and that's why.
So you've got Katie Holmes and Tom Cruise and Donald Trump and Melania, and everybody wants to sort of be in that same league?
Right. I mean, you know, people see these weddings. They see them in tabloid magazines, or they see them in something like InStyle weddings, which is consensual coverage of celebrity weddings. So, you know, they're not even pictures taken by paparazzi, but they're staged, and the photographer is welcome to be there. So, you know, these are very you know, these are very influential. I mean, I met one wedding, would-be wedding planner, a young woman who was from Brooklyn. She was African-American, and she wanted to, she'd grown up in the projects in Brooklyn. She didn't have a lot of money, and she wanted to stage, she wanted to plan weddings for people of her, you know, her friends, her peers.
Sure.
And she had tried to emulate the wedding of Melissa Rivers, Joan Rivers' daughter, who had this spectacular winter wonderland wedding at the Plaza Hotel that cost
gazillions of dollars. Sort of a czarist Russia kind of
exactly,
thing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. This young woman had emulated this wedding on a budget of $200, and she'd done it by going to the dollar store and getting leftover lights from Christmas and spray painting branches white. And, you know, this is very enterprising of her, and it was very, I was filled with admiration for her. Her effort. I mean, I didn't know how she was going to go on to make a living from doing weddings like this. And also, you know, very
cheap.
Right. And she also told me, you know, at the end of the evening, the bride had had to open the envelopes in which she had been given cash gifts in order to pay the DJ because she'd actually gone over budget. Now, you know, this is a very I mean, of course, people want to have a memorable day. Everybody does. And that's, you know, it's a very significant day, a wedding day. But, you know, wanting to emulate the celebrity culture to the extent that you're opening your wedding presents to pay off the DJ, maybe not such a great idea.
But let me ask you, I mean, if you look back at the old photographs, Marilyn Monroe and Joe DiMaggio, or Elvis and Priscilla Presley, I mean, these were celebrities, but nothing like super grand scale weddings. Is there something, I don't know, something in this generation that has brought it back to the, or back or to the future or forward, you tell us, to the notion that it has to be kind of this big, conventional, you know, every bow and ribbon sort of treatment of the wedding? Is there something about the psychology of the 20-somethings getting married now?
Well, I went to a very interesting presentation by a by the editor of Modern Brides magazine, who spoke about the so-called echo boom bride. And these are the brides who are children of baby boomers. And they're just now getting up to the age at which they get married, or as she put it, entering the engagement zone. So it sounds sort of science fiction-y,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Yeah, these young women have, you know, there are a couple of things that are very, from the perspective of the wedding business, very, very encouraging. They're quite conservative culturally. They're not like their parents. They're not rebellious. They don't want to change the world. They kind of just want to get, they want to get a good job, have a good relationship with their family. These things, when you ask this group of this age group what their values are, those are their values. And so having a wedding is part of that, you know, having a big wedding is part of that desire for a sort of conventional life, although what they want is what the editor of Modern Brides referred to as a spin on tradition, which is to say they don't really want to have it like their grandmother had it, because that would be the kind of simple wedding that you're remembering and we're talking about. No, they want something that feels traditional and looks traditional, but is actually comprised of many, you know, new, created, invented, exaggerated tradition.
Traditional-esque is a word that comes out in your book. Like what?
Yeah.
Like what sort of new faux tradition?
Well, I mean, something like, you know, the popularization of the personalized aisle runner. I mean, you know, people have like an aisle runner.
What is that now? Is that a person or a thing or a place?
No, it's a thing that goes down on the aisle, and you walk down the aisle, and you can have it sort of monogrammed or personalized.
Oh, I see,
or something.
Your name on the red carpet or white carpet.
Yeah, exactly. Well, something like, you know, a very funny, I mean, a sort of comic invented tradition is the inclusion of pets in ceremonies, and you can buy little wings for your dog to wear participate, because now these days people think of their pets as part of their family, right? So the idea is not that you're doing this kooky thing by having a dog in your ceremony. Uh-huh. What you're doing is including all the members of your family, and that includes your pet dog. So the new is sold under the guise of the traditional, or an extension of the tradition.
Well, wings on a dog, that's something new. Let's go to Cynthia in Boston. Cynthia, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Cynthia, obviously. But I've worked in the catering business part-time for over 10 years.
Yeah.
And I originally got involved in this field to pay for my own wedding. having worked in more than 100 weddings, my experience have led me to believe that weddings really have shifted from having a sentimental meaning to more of a stage show that has very little to do with the actual ritual of the two people coming together.
So what, it's like putting on an opera now or something?
And, you know, I've actually seen brides and grooms walk around with scripts of, you know, you're supposed to go over here now. Now you're supposed to cut the cake. When you cut the cake, this is what you do.
But hasn't it always been a kind of show in that way? Isn't that what rehearsals and rehearsal dinners are all about?
Well, you know, it's funny because, like I said, it's been over 10 years. And at first, it seems like when the market was going really well and strong, it was all about the bigger show. And, you know, I've seen the shift, you know, just go bigger and bigger to the point where I've seen brides take, you know, money out of the envelopes that they receive from gifts to pay for the catering and as far as tips and so forth.
Is it a problem, Cynthia, if it becomes a big show, or is that just a bigger celebration of a big day?
It just seems to have taken away from the actual ceremony of these two people coming together. I mean, I don't know if it's, I mean, I think it's a problem because I see a lot of glitz and glam, and then when it's over, it's the bride is running around trying to, you know, gather her things, and it's just not as glamorous as it appeared to be.
Right. when the show folds, there we are, human beings who are now married. But Cynthia, thanks for that. Rebecca, though, I read you saying that part of the reason for all the effort and all the investment is to hold the marriage day up, that perfect day, as a kind of talisman to bring a happy marriage for kids who may have seen a lot of divorce in their family or in their world.
I mean, I think that there is this element of magical thinking that if we do the wedding, if we do it the way that we're supposed to do it according to the bridal media and so on, then yes, there's the hope that it will hold us together. I mean, I it doesn't make any sense rationally, and of course one knows from experience that it doesn't, that it's just not true. I mean, again, look at Charles and Diana. But, you know, the people want their weddings to be meaningful and they want their marriages to last. And so, you know, the sort of confluence of desire happens. And, you know, but at the same time, as Cynthia was just saying, the you know, this focus upon production values over, you know, the real meaning of a wedding is no preparation for marriage. In fact, it's a distraction from the real meaning of marriage, I think. And so, you know, there's nothing about spending 16 months, you know, as Jonathan from South Carolina was talking about, matching your napkins to your ribbons. There's nothing about that that prepares you for married life, unless you're going into the catering business, and then maybe it's a help, you know.
you followed it right down to Disney World's Wedding Pavilion, where you can rent Cinderella's coach to ride off in for $2,500 per ceremony. Just one more piece on the big tote bill.
Right, and what's very interesting about Disney is that, you know, people wanted to get married there. They realized that there was a market. This is in the early 90s. They realized that there was a market for people having small ceremonies there. But what they then realized is that, hey, wait a minute, if we can get people not just to come, the two of them, to get married and have a quick photograph taken and the rest of it, but if we can get them to bring their families here, if we can get them all to stay here for a week, then we're filling hotel rooms that at the time were being challenged by other resorts at Branson, Missouri, and so on.
We're talking about the American wedding and what it's become, the wedding industrial complex and our new wedding day dreams. Rebecca Mead is here, a writer, staff writer for New Yorker, the New Yorker magazine. Her new book is One Perfect Day, The Selling of the American Wedding. Let's keep the sound of such days in our ears. Here's in a show famously about swinging singles and big money style, Sex and the City. There was a memorably down-to-earth wedding scene, famously, 2004, between characters Miranda and Steve. Low-key coup here against the New York blockbuster wedding took place in a community garden, here with Carrie, Samantha, and the couple's young child looking on. Miranda and Steve give their little vows. No white dress. Miranda wears red.
I, Miranda Hobbs.
I, Miranda Hobbs.
Take you, Steve Brady.
Take you, Steve Brady.
To be my husband.
To be my husband.
For better or worse.
Mommy, Daddy, worse.
For richer or poorer.
For richer or poorer.
In sickness and in health.
In sickness and in health.
To love and to cherish as long as we both shall live.
To love and to cherish as long as we both shall live.
This is my solemn vow.
This is my solemn vow.
Do you promise to uphold these vows you've made here today, witnessed by your closest friends and family?
I do.
I do.
A little red dress, a little park, and off they go. Deb is calling from Boston. Deb, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom and Rebecca. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment and probably echo some of what Cynthia said. I eloped with my husband 14 years ago. We went to Alexandria, Virginia, because we could do it quickly there. And it was very romantic. I wore jeans. It stands out as one of the best memories of my life. But I did feel for a year or two after our wedding, like, gee, maybe, you know, we didn't really have a wedding, and I'd have these dreams about not really being married because we didn't do it, quote unquote, the right way. But that feeling has dissipated to the point where it no longer exists. Every time I go to a traditional wedding, whether it's a good friend or someone that we just happen to know through business or even members of my family, because what I see is, and, you know, usually people will tell you, they'll give you some idea of how much they've spent, and you see them running around, and what always strikes me is that I don't see the couple interacting that much. There's only one wedding I can think of that I went to where I saw the couple, you know, actually sitting together and being alone together. Usually it's like they're playing party hosts and hostesses, and I understand why you'd want to do that, but, you know, it feels to me like, oh, you know, isn't this supposed to be about you? And isn't this supposed
of course,
to be your
you eloped. You're the adventurer who just went out there and did it. I love it, Deb. Rebecca, you describe a lot of people on the way to this grand wedding say, oh, why don't we just elope?
Yeah, well, you hear that very often because elopement, you know, used to be that you were running away from a disapproving family or disapproving society at large. And nowadays, elopement means running away from the wedding industry. You don't want to have a big wedding, so that's what you're escaping. But the thing is that there is now an elopement industry. I mean, they've got there before you.
Right.
And so, you know, the weddings are great tourism opportunities for destinations. And I mean, I went to Jamaica, which is a very big wedding destination. And there's a chain of hotels there called Sandals. I went to one hotel where they do an average of 5 weddings a day, sometimes as many as 10. And, you know, it's fascinating to watch because they'll have a wedding cake. It's a 2-tiered wedding cake. And you have your wedding, they bring you the cake, they take the top tier off, and you cut the cake, and the photographer takes a picture of you cutting the cake. While you're doing that, some other Sandals employee is taking away the bottom part of the cake, which is not made from cake, it's made from styrofoam, is carrying it off
to go to the next
wedding because there's somebody else just down the beach is going to get married in another half an hour.
Well, maybe there's some hope of economizing if that's going on then. Let's go to Mitch. Let's go to Mitch in Flint, Michigan, Rebecca. Mitch, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom and Rebecca, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a wedding DJ, and I have DJed a lot of weddings over the years. Sometimes I get a tip, sometimes I don't. I work really hard to make it a special day and have a good time, and sometimes they'll walk right up at the beginning of the night and hand me an envelope, and then other times I think I'm going to get one, but I don't.
But Mitch, Rebecca tells us they're already paying $28,000 on average. Can you imagine? Maybe they're tapped out.
But you tip the limo driver. He just drives and opens the door. I pick every song. I take requests.
The wedding singer, the wedding DJ is here. We'll answer your question, but you tell us first, Mitch, do you see weddings changing? Different scale, different grandeur, or is it pretty much the same?
No, I've seen some changes where people are combining the two. They'll elope, come back, plan a party sometimes in a tent in the backyard, or they'll rent a hall, make it more casual, which I think is nice because then you're cutting down somewhat on cost, and when you can make it casual for your guests, then it takes pressure off them to dress up.
Right.
But for the most part, I still see a lot of the standard weddings, and it's funny to see all this beautiful day go by and then to see the bride and groom folding up chairs and cleaning tables.
hey, what about hiring that help as well? But what about it, Rebecca? Mitch wants to know, I'm the DJ, where's my tip? Are people tapped out by tipping time?
Well, everybody's, I mean, you know, this is the thing that you asked earlier, what is the wedding industry? I mean, it's a very, very splintered, disaggregated business. It's mostly made up, and many parts made up of small people like Mitch, you know, who've got a business that, you know, is just them or, you know, a few employees. It's not mostly not huge monolithic corporations, although there are those, for example, in the registry business. You know, department stores and specialty stores are very, very concerned with getting the custom of brides and grooms, because this is a wonderful age at which to get a customer. If you if the bride registers with your brand, the hope is that she will continue to buy your brand for the next 50 years of her life. So there are these large corporations that are interested in this market, but it's also a lot of small independent business people like that. And of course, they're all looking, you know, for their cut, for their tip, for the whole, for their piece of the pie. As one personal trainer I met who was deciding he was going to go into personal training brides
to have those toned arms for the wedding dress.
Yeah.
Oh
yeah,
boy, exactly. Mitch, I don't know the answer, but I see what you're up against when Papa and Mama have already spent that much by the time it gets to you. Let's go to North Liberty, Iowa, and Aaron. Hi, Aaron. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My husband and I got married in July 2002 at a magistrate's office. It took 10 minutes. His fee was $30. I wore a pink dress, and we had the best time. And I can't imagine spending so much money on weddings. We couldn't have afforded it, and I wouldn't have wanted to anyway. Too much stress.
And you don't wake up in the middle of the night thinking, oh, good heavens, I missed my big chance?
Absolutely not.
$30, justice of the peace, and off you go. That's great. I love it, but it gets done every which way, I guess. Let's go to Andrew in Stonington, Connecticut. Andrew, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm actually an ordained minister who has been doing a lot of weddings, especially over the past year. And I wanted to comment because, especially with the rise in New England for recognizing same-sex marriages and civil unions, I see a lot of the trends going to outside the religious building, into parks and different things like that. And I'm noticing that some of the weddings are actually very elaborate, where they spend a lot of money to make their day memorable. But I'm also seeing a lot of, because of the interfaith marriages, them going very, very simplistic. And, you know,
What exactly do you mean by simplistic, Andrew?
Going to basically minimalistic, where there's no formality. They want the quick, simple ceremonies. And, you know, I've seen other people who have no problem doing an hour-long ceremony. I've seen people do it as short as 10 minutes. And, you know, I'd like to hear some response on, you know, the actual ceremony and ritual part of it, and whether or not they actually feel that there is, you know, promotion of the religious institutions still left in the ceremony.
Right. Andrew, stick with us. Rebecca, what have you seen at the heart of all this great hullabaloo? What about the core rituals, the vows themselves? What do you see happening there?
Right. Well, it's fascinating. I mean, there are an increasing number of independent, non-affiliated ministers, sort of freelance wedding ministers, who, you know, the only thing they do is do weddings. That's why they get the ordination, in order to be able to do weddings. I actually spoke to one gentleman who was a DJ. DJ Bob was his name, but he was also Reverend Bob, and he could do both.
But does it mean they're not really religious, or is it a kind of new ministry? What
he is an ordained minister. He's legally allowed to do it.
But you can get that for $25 in the mail. I mean, to Andrew's question.
Yes, And a lot of people do. I mean, wedding planners are advised to get that ordination so that if the minister doesn't show up, you'll be able to do it for you. But it's interesting because churches and houses of worship are, you know, I've heard a lot of frustration from ministers, you know, real pulpit ministers who are very frustrated by doing weddings because they find that people are focusing on what the church is going to look like, whether the flowers are right, whether they're allowed to have the photographer in there taking the pictures at the right moment, and, you know, much less focused upon the ceremony. And in fact, ministers will say things like, I'd much rather do funerals, because at funerals, people are really focused upon the important things, life
serious.
And death. And
yeah.
At a wedding, it's people are, you know, worried about what the production values are. So there's definitely, many churches are sort of issuing guidelines. I mean, the Episcopal Church of New York offered issued guidelines for its ministers about what is and isn't allowed. And, you know, they say by no means have a wedding planner. You know, there's no place for a wedding planner actually in the, you know, telling you how to do the ceremony. So, you know, there's a sense that among the clergy, too, that the way weddings are conducted is out of control.
Andrew, do you have a feeling that you're losing your grip on the greatest show on earth here?
Well, I'm feeling that when they go to outside institutions, they lose a lot of what, as ministers, we do. We sometimes set up counseling sessions to make sure that they understand the choices that they're making, and I'm feeling that they're losing a major portion of that understanding when they do the shotgun weddings and different things like that.
Or weddings driven by the marketing and not so much by the ritual and tradition. Andrew,
well,
thanks.
That,
Rebecca?
Sorry. You know, I think that this is a very important point, and it's one of the central points that I wanted to investigate in the book. I mean, the question I was asking myself was, you know, which authorities do we turn to now to tell us how to get married? I mean, getting married is a tremendously important thing. Mm. And people want to do it with ceremony, and they want to do it with a sense that they are joining something and belonging to something that's larger than themselves and larger than their own powers of self-invention. So, you know, what authority do we turn to? It used to be much more that we would turn to the authority of the church or a house of worship, or that there would be social structures and family structures that would tell us, you know, this is how you go about doing things. Well, increasingly in our culture, in weddings, as in so many other spheres of our lives, commerce is the authority to which we turn, and the people that are telling us how to have a wedding are the people who are selling us the stuff to have the wedding. But, you know, people want an authority. They want to know who, they want someone to tell them how to do it.
And that authority may now be a magazine, Modern Bride,
exactly.
or something
exactly.
else. Let's take a call from Elizabeth in Wakefield, Massachusetts. Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm wondering if your guest has an opinion about the relationship between how much people get into the wedding and how long the marriage lasts. Because in my opinion, people who get that over the top over the wedding are not into the marriage.
Well, do you have? Are you a wedding professional, Elizabeth?
Well, I used to be in catering, and now I am in a makeup artist, and so I've dealt with at least my share of brides. And it just seems to me that the more invested they are in the wedding, the less they are in the groom.
The groom or the marriage?
I shouldn't say the groom. The marriage as a whole.
Right, so the more eyeliner, the less longevity. Well, Rebecca, what do you say?
You know, I mean, there are no, unfortunately, no statistical surveys of this kind of thing. But I think that, you know, I mean, common sense tells you that planning a wedding isn't, you know, or having a wedding is no guarantee for the future happiness of your marriage. I read a wonderful article in a magazine that I became very addicted to while I was writing this book, called Vows Magazine, which is the trade magazine for the wedding dress business. And it's like reading, sort of stepping through the looking glass and reading the other side of Brides Magazine. This is the people that are selling you the stuff. And there was a very interesting article that was telling retailers how to appeal to the so-called non-traditional bride. And one way of identifying the non-traditional bride was that, to quote the article, she's more focused upon the marriage than the wedding. If you're a wedding dress retailer, yeah, this is a very worrying idea that the woman might be more focused upon the marriage than the wedding. Of course, you know, I tend to think that it's probably the better focus.
And yet, with all this, everything you found, Rebecca, I mean, these are still people who are stepping up, who clearly long to have a great life together. I mean, that impulse is still at the heart of it with all the, you know, celebration, fal-de-ral, you may call it a waste, others may call it a wonderful celebration of life. The core impulse has got to be sitting right there in the middle of it.
Of course it is, and it's very profound, and it's very moving, and I am, you know, I'm as moved by it and as much participating in it as the next person. What I'm interested in is looking at is how that impulse, which is a very human one, is taken and translated and used by the wedding industry to further its own ends. And what does that say about us as a culture at large? What does it, you know, I believe that the way that we marry tells us who we are, and I mean that as a culture. So.
And we marry grand these days. Maybe maybe that's who we are. Rebecca Mead's book is One Perfect Day, The Selling of the American Wedding. Rebecca, thanks for your big wedding safari. Thanks for spending some time with us. Great to have you.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We go out with the great old one, Wedding March from Felix Mendelssohn. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.